shaped.
One of the parts of religious Zionism, I think it's very, very timely because Rav Druckman, who was recently Nifter, and I think his Shloshim was a day or two ago, is probably responsible for shaping, I wouldn't call it mainstream, because that would give the impression that people who had slightly different variations are not mainstream, but certainly a much more popular influence. You could say that he took Rav Kook's ideas about religious Zionism and created a culture in a community. So if you interview, again, it's a loose association, but people who believe in religious Zionist ideas, and you say, well, who's their ideologue, who's the person that represents their values, their mission, a lot of them would point to Rav Druckman. Few would point to people like Rav Amital, although he's had a significant impact. And what were some of the difference between, like people like to call them Chardal versus not Chardal? I hate those terms. They're very, very suffocating. But one of the ways that Rav Amital changed Zionism is that as it was unfolding, and it wasn't just ideas that were being postulated in theory in a vacuum, there's actually ideas that were taking root in reality in a real world with war, with Arabs, with society, with settlement, with tensions, with regressions in the process. So Rav Amital created what I call a stabilized Zionism, where there was a redemptive fervor to it. But it was a redemptive fervor that was very pragmatic and very grounded and very realistic and balanced some of the potential fanaticism that messianism can create. So one of his famous ideas is an idea expressed in Parsha Shmos / Va'era. So we'll take a look at that juncture today. And I'll try to elaborate on that idea and try to bring a corollary to the idea. In Parsha's Va'era, sounds like there's a whole new beginning. Moshe tried, Moshe failed, and we expect Moshe to try again. So he was unsuccessful his first round. We should witness Moshe walk back into the palace, try to convince Paro, try to rally the Jews. Yet, Va'era sounds like a whole new beginning. You could very easily swap in Va'era for Shmos, and it would sound like the beginning of the process. When Hashem comes to Moshe, again, you don't see the suffering, you don't see the enslavement, but in theory, we could begin Parsha Shmos, Sefer Shmos, with Vayera l'Avraham al Yitzchak v'al Yaakov b'Kel Shakai, Ushmi Hashem lo nadati lehem. I appeared to the Avos in one form, now I'm appearing to you in a superior form of Gilui Shechina, and I'm here to redeem the Jewish people. Potzesi v'itzalti v'galti v'kachti. That would be a very dramatic way to begin. So for all sorts of reasons, which are legitimate, Shmos precedes Vayera. Okay, but Vayera begins as if it's totally, totally ignorant of Shmos. If a whole new beginning, all of these things have been said already. In different terms, you don't have the four languages of Geula, you don't have certain additions, but you would expect Va'era to be, continue your mission. You failed, it wasn't that great, try again, wipe off the dust, go to Paro, try to convince him. Instead, it's very bombastic. Va'era l'Avraham l'Yitzchak v'Yaakov b'Kel Shakai, Shmei Hashem l'Nadati, and here I am. Sounds like there's a rupture between Shmos and Va'era. There's something missing in the in-between that we're not privy to in the psukim that justify this whole new beginning. And it's precisely here that Chazal fill in the blanks. And we'll read the medrash later, but let's first wrap our heads around it. Chazal say that in the end of Shmos, when Moshe Rabbeinu was hooted at and ridiculed and mocked and scorned, and everyone was pelting him with tomatoes and with lettuce and booing him, and Paro was laughing at him, and the Jews were angry at him, and the policemen were screaming, everyone's noisy and angry and screaming, Moshe runs home to Midian. Moshe takes his bag, takes his stick, probably takes his kids and wife with him, because remember, his kids and wife are with him in the middle of Shmos on the way to Mitzrayim, but not with him during Yitzias Mitzrayim. That's why Yisro has to bring them to Har Elokim in the beginning of Yisro. So at some point, they magically disappear. So Chazal are probably filling in the blanks. Moshe said, this isn't going to be as easy as I thought. I'm going to hit with a lot of resistance. There's going to be a lot of anger. You better go back to Midian. Oh, Moshe takes him back to Midian. You stay here. I'll go back for a second shot. Now, how long Moshe was off the grid, we don't know. Two different versions in Chazal. Doesn't make much of a difference. One says 3 months. One says 6 months. It doesn't make much of a difference for the purposes of the story. What story are Chazal saying? Basically, Moshe's geula screeched to a halt in the end of Shmos, and he went back home. And then the process is restarting, so to speak, in the beginning of Va'era, hence a whole new launch. The new launch. Not just round through and get back in there. It's a new launch. What's the message? Well, could you imagine if you were standing there in Egypt, watching your babies thrown into the Nile, working all day, being spat on, being enslaved, building pyramids, being raped, being killed, and Moshe comes and he rallies and there's excitement and there's ardor and vision and everything falls off. Everything goes south quickly, goes off the skids. And then you see Moshe walk away and leave the scene. What would you say? Yeah, failed Messiah. There he is. Some guy raised our ambitions, raised our expectations. It's all been dashed. He was a failure. Shabtai Tzvi, continue working. Didn't mean anything. Because after all, if it were redemptive, it would have succeeded at first, right? And you would have thought that Moshe's redemption had failed and it ended. Now, 2020 hindsight, you know, that was, what, 3 months, 6 months? 3 months or 6 months in the span of 210 years. It's like a hiccup. It's like a sneeze. Moshe was just recharging his batteries, just getting things back in order, getting his ducks in a row, coming back. So even though textually, obviously, we have to announce it's a new beginning, but obviously, Shmos and Bayer are the same process and happened within the same year. And the takeaway is, and I'll tell you when the takeaway was so important, and then I'll tell you how to develop the takeaway. The takeaway is that when redemption happens, when Geula happens, and I keep telling you, we don't have a tradition for Geula. Okay, if we have to know the halachos of, I don't know, matzah, we'll look up the Gemara, we'll look up the Tosfos, we'll look up the Shulchan Aruch, we'll look up what the Vilna Gaon said, we'll look up what the Chafetz Chaim said. We have long traditions about halacha. We've never been through Geula. And we certainly don't have any recorded works about Geula, any roadmaps. We're learning this process. And it's going to take us a few generations to learn the process. How does Geula unfold? Especially since we don't even know how it's going to, not even if I could find the target, it's a moving target because by definition, Geula is Hashem's intervention in history, and we're never going to be able to define it through human terms. That's what makes it redemptive, because Hashem intervenes and changes our world in ways that we can. But at least to develop a language and an orientation and an attitude takes a while. And people, one of the expectations people have of Geula is that it's overnight, and that it's apocalyptic, and that it's instant, and that the world changes, and Hashem snaps his fingers. Oh, that movie, I took my kids to the movie a couple of years ago. I fell asleep, but I'm comfortable. The guy snapped his fingers, and all the people turned into Das Avengers, right? Thanos, when he snapped his finger. So he snapped your finger. I was enjoying the big sea. I was trying to sleep. Snap your finger, and all of a sudden, the world changes. And then when reality doesn't cooperate, and reality is slow, and reality is arduous, and reality is complicated, and sometimes redemption pauses. People delude themselves. People lose hope and lose faith. When I was living, I made Aliyah in 1993. All of a sudden, rude introduction to the state of Israel. 1994, they signed the peace deal with the Palestinians. Now, I don't bring politics into the room, discussing whether you should have supported that or not, but it was a rude awakening. It's not the Israel I moved to. It's a whole different story. And a lot of people started to question, I don't care about what you say, I care about what you think. Whether we should say Reishit Tzmichat Geula Teinu and Tefillah, whether we shouldn't say Reishit Tzmichat Geula Teinu and Tefillah, don't get caught up with all those issues. I remember when I lived in America, the couple years I lived in America, after I was here in Yeshiva, so I had a decision about where to daven. And there were two shuls in Brooklyn, there were many more than two shuls, but there were two types of shuls. There was one type of shul which did not say Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina. There was one type of shul which said Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina, but there was so much talking, you couldn't hear it anyway. So I had to decide which shul to daven in. So I said, look, Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina, that's a wash. I'm not going to hear it anyway. Either because I won't say it, because I won't hear it. Now I have to decide where I'm going to daven in a way that means davening is meaningful. My point is, don't get caught up. I know many, many fine people who live for the state of Israel and live for Jewish redemption in all the right ways, and don't feel that you should say words that aren't in Chazal or aren't in the liturgy, so they won't say it. I know many people just rifle off and parrot the words, and it doesn't mean anything to them. Right? So people always ask me, can you come speak for Yom HaTzmut? I say, I'll speak about everything you want, anything under the sun about Yom HaTzmut. The one thing I will not speak about is should you or should you say Hallel? Why? Because I don't care. It's not an issue. If you feel you should say Hallel, say Hallel. Say you don't. And just because you say Hallel doesn't mean you're part of Geula. Part of Geula is thinking, living. Just because you don't say Hallel doesn't mean you're not. It's a halacha question. That's in the end of the day what it all boils down to. We're sharing whether we should say Hallel. So I refuse to midgetize Yom HaTzmut into whether we should or shouldn't say Hallel. There's so much more to it than the halacha question. You can feel like halachically, I'm saying Hallel with a bracha. Well, because that's my Masarim, I'm never going to elevate you. He was very careful about saying a bracha before Hallel. I think I'm a pretty big Zionist. I've lived in Gush for 40 years. I hold a flag. It's just, I don't say Hallel with a bracha because I feel halachically that's something I don't feel comfortable. get past all these codes and easy definitions of who's what and who's where. They're silly. So a lot of people were saying, maybe this isn't redemptive. Maybe this isn't Gula. Maybe we should give up hope because we're giving land to the Palestinians because not everything is happening as cracked up as it cracked up to be. And people had a hard time with that. And this is really when Rav Avital would quote these Midrashim to us and say, that's not what Gula is. Gula is not immediate. It wasn't so in Mitzrayim. And here's the punchline. What are the words we use to describe Gulas Mitzrayim? Ki b'chi pazon. Yatzasa meretz Mitzrayim. It says, and once in bo, and once in re'e. Ki b'chi pazon, yatzasa meretz Mitzrayim. What's the mitzvah that captures the chipazon? The matzah. Everything was so rushed. And Yeshaya tells us, it's one of the nevuos, if you take a look at source number 5, that unlike Mitzrayim, right, you don't have a clear roadmap for the final gula, but you do have codes. Okay, it's not as if you have to close your eyes and jump into the pool. You read Tanakh, you read Midrashim, you read Chazal, there's certain codes that are more, not more or less, but more or less than more, but certain ways. And one of the code words for the final gula is in Yeshaya. Source number 5. Ki lo b'chipazon teizeu. In the end of time, it will not happen b'chipazon. Uvim nusa lo teilechon. And you won't run. Namely, there's a contrast between our geula and geulas Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was chipazon. And Yeshaya is saying, get ready. Your geula won't be chipazon. And look at that. Even Mitzrayim, which was chipazon, wasn't really chipazon. Because it happened in two stages. Again, those two stages are 3-6 months apart. Not a big deal. But structurally, modularly, Hashem was delivering a model that there can be a pause. It can be a pause of 3 years, it can be a pause for 10 years, and not only can there be a pause, there can even be a lag, there can be reversals. It doesn't mean the overall trajectory is not redemptive. It just means that history is very, very riotous, and history is very, very uneven. History is very, very uncontrollable. And who knows? It could be 20 years away from it, it could be 200 years away from it. It doesn't make a difference. It's still a process that we've started, and it's still a process that we are contributing to redemption, not only, right? People ask me, when did redemption start? There's only one answer for when redemption started. Redemption started the moment the last Jew left Yerushalayim after the Roman conquest and performed the first mitzvah. Because until the last Jew left, it wasn't Galus. Once he left, Galus was complete. Once he did his first mitzvah, Gula started. Because Gula is an aggregate process of every mitzvah, every tefillah, every act of tzedakah, every tikkun chatzos, every chesed, every dipping in the mikvah that every Jew has performed on behalf of Gula for thousands of years. It's a graph. Look at my hands, like a graph. And then all of a sudden, 1948, the graph quickly curves. And it curves in two ways. Number one, the altitude shifts. So it's moving at a greater pitch rather than a slower gradient. Number two, and here's a whole new graph is opened. And that's what happens in 48. Not only does the arc change its gradient, there's a whole new graph that opens. This is the graph for the last 2,000 years. Redemption in a metaphysical sense. I'm in Poland. I'm learning Gemara. How do I know I'm redeemed? Okay, in Shemayim, it's all counting. I'm a woman. I'm never a woman. I'm a woman in Spain. I'm going to the mikvah. Metaphysically, every mitzvah I'm doing contributes to Gula. Now, a whole new graph of redemption opens. That's called, not metaphysical, but material redemption. An army, a police force, a land, buildings, people, water, agriculture. And that we never had. We never contributed to redemption in a material way. We contributed to redemption in a metaphysical way. And then we have to continue both those contributions. That's what makes our life so difficult, because we want to be part of both graphs. A Haredi will say, I'm still part of only one graph. And I'm going to intensely invest only in the metaphysical graph, because that's the only graph that counts. And our position is, let's try to build both graphs. But it's at great, great cost to the metaphysics. But we feel that's the blend that's necessary. Yes? Remind me of your name?
I'm Dolly. My question is that, do you think, like, 1948 was a
Geula
or a Z
Geula? I'm not sure that, you have to tell me what you mean more specifically.
Meaning, like, it was obviously a redemption, but it's like the final redemption. Or
this
like,
is, yes, I believe this is the end.
Okay.
But it's not, the end can take hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Where I told you that, to my metaphor, if I were to be writing the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina, I would not use the Reishis Michas Gula Seinu, because it's taken from Yeshaya. I would use a different metaphor. I may not fit good into the Lashon. I think about four rooms of history. told you this. The first room, pre-Har Sinai. Second room, supernatural, revelation, miracles, 1,300 years, Har Sinai, till the Gullus, Shani. Third is the 2,000 years of Gullus. The fourth room is the final room of history. How long will it take us to traverse that room? I don't know. But we're in the room. And we have a Masara that there will not be a third Korban, because there are only two Tochachot in the Torah, and each Tochachot corresponds to one of the Gullus's, and this is what Rav Unterman, Zichrono Livracha, says, what Herzog said during the eve of independence in World War II. At our lowest moments, when people thought we were heading for Armageddon, and we were heading for another disaster, and then we were going to be kicked out of the land, all of our Rabbanim said we have a Masara. Throughout all of Chazal, there will be two Gullus's, the first Gullus Bavel and Gullus Esav. And the prospect that millions of Jews are returning home and then Chas V'Shalom are evicted, that's not just an event, that's a Gullus. And we have a Masara that it won't happen. So no one knows what will happen in this country. Baruch Hashem, we've lived with Hashem's Hashgacha more or less during your lifetime. You're about 20 years, 21, 22, most of you. More or less for the last 20 years or so, it's been relatively quiet. Baruch Hashem, right? When I look at the figures each year, the percentages, it's just ungodly. I mean, it's godly, it's uncommon. It's just how many soldiers are, not that any soldier should be killed, but you're running a major army, you're fighting battles on multiple fronts, the homicidal neighbors. You're talking about maybe 30 or 40 soldiers a year who die in battle, and of them, you know, X amount of suicides, which of course is a casualty of running an army because it's army related and pressure, and X amount of people who were involved in vehicular accidents, sadly enough, they just happen to be soldiers, so they're counted as soldier death, and Y amount are training accidents, which is also part of the army. But in terms of the actual battle, it was like one or two. So Baruch Hashem, we're living through, and I told you, people talk about how dangerous Eretz Yisrael is. It's not dangerous. It is infinitely safer than anywhere you come from. It's all psychological. You walk into a random street in New York City, you're in far, far greater danger. The answer is there, it's random. No one is bullseyeing you for violence. Here, they want you. But that's all just fear. That's also psychology. You have to defeat psychology with courage. You can't defeat psychology with numbers. Numbers are numbers. I told you the story with the three boys in the Satmar Rebbe. I never told you that story? A couple of years ago, when the three boys were kidnapped, so I sadly had a very intimate encounter with it, because my son, who's now married and living in Lod, my son was very close with Naftali Frankel, one of the boys. And just to mention, his family, they're just amazing people. They've heard Racheli Frankel speak, so you probably know her as a public figure in her shiurim. But she adopted, namely her, she and her husband, they adopted Naftali's friends, like the five or six friends. And they became B'nai Bayit, they would come for Shabbaton, and they resent my son's wedding. He had a bracha, like he became like a second father, which is just amazing, amazing people. They lost their own son, and they're watching their son's friends grow up, get married, continue with their lives. So anyway, so I was trying to be more involved during that summer, just to give people in Chutz Laaretz more of a sense of what was going on, Facebook posts, and recordings, and pictures, and just keep being a keyhole. Right? I told you, the secret to Facebook and Twitter and social media, looking for one secret is, be a connector, don't be a promoter. Okay, that's what you should be, a connector, not a promoter. What does it mean to be a connector? There are things in your life of importance, of content, that other people may want to be part of, and you're the bridge. And social media is where you bridge people. So if you, let's say, I don't know, sometimes I like to post sunsets. I know that for people in Chutz Laaretz, seeing a sunset in Gush, or many people that are close to Gush, seeing a sunset is something very exciting to them. So I'll post. So I'm connecting people to a sunset they can't see that I'm seeing. I'm connecting people, 99.9% of us are shiur. So I have a shiur, so for me it's a bulletin board. Here's a shiur you all know how to get to, I'm connecting you to it. Okay? The other form of social media, which is a lack of tznias, and tznias has nothing to do with how you dress, that's only one expression of tznias, is promoting yourself. Look at the hamburger I ate. Look at the party I went to. Look at me, look at me. You're attracting people to you, rather than attracting people to something that you are involved in and bridging them to. It's so important. Otherwise, you're just promoting, 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 and then you become a promotionalist, an exhibitionist, and you cover your body with 14 layers of clothing. It still means you don't have tznias. Tznias is if you project yourself or you try to project away from yourself. And it's a tonality, and it's a state of mind. And now, right in the middle of things I always struggle with is, what about, like, whenever I make a mitzvah, Shem Tzvim was getting married this Wednesday night, my daughter, so will I post pictures? So on the one hand, my talmidim, let's say, would be very excited because I remember growing up in the house and having her on their lap and babysitting and whatever. On the other hand, I just feel like it's not my right to post pictures because they may be my children, but they're their own people. So I would never post a picture of someone. You're not just my child, you're your own person. But let's say I was making a bar mitzvah for my cardboard son. You know, my son is a cardboard, and doesn't have any feelings. So I'm making a bar mitzvah for my cardboard son, and my son really wouldn't care because I'm not connecting people with me. I'm connecting people with my happiness that they're a part of. But try to always remember that differentiation. It's not always clear-cut, but if you are using social media, connect to something that people will be interested in beyond yourself. Now, simcha is beyond yourself. So you want to join my simcha. But just the fact that you drove a car, or went and had a hamburger, or a nice picture of yourself, or why would you post pictures of that? That's not sneaks. Okay, getting back to that summer. So the Satmar Rebbe, at some point, came out in the middle of the summer, and he said the following: okay, girls, get ready to hyperventilate, to faint, because you know, right? The Satmar Rebbe said that it is the fault of those parents that the three boys were killed, because they sent their children into a danger zone to educate them. So it's their fault, not Hamas's fault. I was screaming. Moral indignance. This is morally degenerate. How could you? So whenever there's this chorus of cacophonous chorus of people screaming, I don't have anything to add. But when I do have something to add, I add it. So I put out a recording, which was titled, Why I Agree with the Satmar Rebbe. Everyone was very interested, as you are, to hear my comments. That was an attention, a clickbait. Why I Agree with the Satmar Rebbe, my form of clickbait. So what I did was as follows. I did some number crunching, and I looked up the statistics of how many teenage boys were killed that summer in Monroe County, which is in Muncie, in New York, where the Satmar Rebbe lives. I took into account all the car accidents and all the drug-related deaths and crime-related and drive-bys and all the children who were killed by violent acts, not necessarily medical issues. Medical issues could be anywhere, but violent acts, car accidents, casualties and crime, whatever, drug crime. And then I compared those numbers to how many teenage boys were killed in Gush Etzion. And it turned out that summer in Monroe County, which was the equivalent population of Gush Etzion, there were, I think, 15 young men between the ages of 13 and 20 who were killed. And in Gush, there were three. So I said, and I did the statistic, I said, you're right. You absolutely have a responsibility to raise your children in a safe environment. And therefore, I ended my recording by saying, the Satmar Rebbe has to send his children to Gush Etzion for high school because he wants them to be in the safest environment. And the safest environment is Gush Etzion, not Monroe County. So so terror is all psychological. And you need courage to be able to defeat it. You need courage. I know I'm veering a little, but we'll get back to the pasuk. When the pasuk says, V'lo Shemuel Moshe mikotzer ruach u'mevodah kasha, but it's a little bit related to Rav Amital. So why did they listen to Moshe? Fascinating psychology. So the simple reading of the pasuk is they're just working too hard. They didn't have the mental space to consider the future. When you work so hard, you lose vision of the future. But look at the Chizkuni. The Chizkuni says something fascinating. He says, you know why they couldn't listen to Moshe? Me'avodah kasha? Because they were burnt already in Parsha Shmos. Because in Parsha Shmos, they believed in Moshe. And what happened to them? It all fell apart. The wheels came off. Pyro increased the workload. They were working double as hard. They were carrying the trauma of Moshe's failed attempt in Shmos. And therefore, they were frightened to believe in him again. Because why should we believe you? We've been burnt already by believing in you. We're not that gullible. They were not just in fear, but they were living through trauma. You hear those two words? Trauma and fear are the same condition. Trauma is just an intense fear that's associated with a person, place, or time. But it's just fear. Trauma is just a fear. It's an irrational fear because it's connected to a real. This is called, they call it anticipatory fear, where you fear something hasn't happened yet, and it's much looser, but it can be very overwhelming. And then the opposite end of the spectrum is trauma, where you fear and you have an unhealthy association with an event, person, or place that causes the fear. But it's the same spectrum of fear. So the question in life is, how do you get past fear? In the end of the day, they were just afraid. They were afraid to listen to Moshe. Again, they were traumatized into fear. It wasn't just your average garden variety fear. They were traumatized into being afraid. How do you get past fear? And there's really only one way to get past fear. And that's why I wanted to tell you about this, because it reminds me of Rav Amital. And it's a trait that isn't spoken about often enough. And I got it from Rav Amital. And again, I'll keep pitching this book to you. Read his biography, read his biography, read his biography. If you haven't already, Hebrew and English. It was a person of uncommon courage. I've never met someone with that much courage. He was just a very courageous person. And I feel bad that I never asked him why he was so courageous. It would have been a hard question to ask him. My senses, like my internal senses, that he went through so many near-death experiences in the Holocaust, that at a certain point you just build up courage because you're no longer afraid. Because once you face death, everything else seems like small change. That's my sense. I never asked him that question, but I do know that in the book, he talks about four or five moments when he's just faced death. And then at that point, oh, I'm afraid of this. I don't mean I'm afraid of boogeyman, a monster. I'm afraid of this person, afraid of this. He just, your ticket to change in life is courage. Because to change, you have to go somewhere you're not there yet. You have to find something you're not. And you have to go into the unknown. And the unknown is always frightening, right? And to overcome that fright, you just have to have courage and say, and it's not faith, obviously, do your homework, ask questions, be responsible. But in the end of the day, you're standing at that chasm, you're standing at a ridge, and you have to jump. And you can say, well, my legs are strong enough to jump, and there's enough bungee cord for me to jump, I can hold on. You go through all the reps, and at the end of the day, you're jumping somewhere you're not. And you need to have the courage to make that leap. And courage is one of those traits that's very, very hard to read about. There's certain traits you can think about outside of the human context. Like I say, we wanted to talk about humility. So I could talk about humility conceptually. What does humility mean conceptually? What are the challenges of humility? How do you build humility? What does humility consist of? Jealousy. I could go through all the traits and talk about them abstractly without mentioning a person. There are certain traits that you have to either see in someone or read about in someone. Either way, you're putting into a human context. Like you read books about people and see that trait in a context of human life, not just in some book. Courage is one. It's a very, very hard trait to describe. It's probably one of the hardest ones. Like, how would I describe courage to you? How would I even catalog it in theory? I can tell you about courageous people I've met and how they've impacted me and how I try to lead my life in accordance with, and how to deal with fear and how to face fear and how to face uncertainty. So getting back to, where was I? How did we talk about that? I don't know. We're talking about redemption, Gula, the fourth room, getting back to somewhere. Anyway, so Rav Amital reminded us that Gula is not going to happen quickly. It doesn't happen immediately. It doesn't happen snap of a finger. Now, Chazal have three images for Gula that convey this gradual sense. They're all different, but they're all the same. Now let's see those three images, okay? The first image, very famous image. Let's start with the pasuk, the Medrash source number 6. Okay, David HaMelech praises Hashem twice, and he uses the same word, but he changes it ever so slightly. And you're all familiar with that change, because he says Magdil Yeshuot Malko in Shmuel Bet, the Oseh Chesed LeMeshicho. So it's a pasuk about redemption, Oseh Chesed LeMeshicho, Yeshuot Malko. And the key word that pops out is the first word, magdil, the tower. In Tehillim, he doesn't use the word magdil, but he uses the word migdol, Yeshuot Malko, V'yosech Aslim Shecho. For our purposes, migdal. Migdol is a form of migdal as opposed to magdil. Magdil is a process of growing, of building. Migdol is a fully finished tower. Migdol. So the Medrash source number 6 says, Katsav Echad Omer Mim Magdil. Because of Echad Omer Migdol, Migdol. I'm reviewed on. Lefi she'ein ha-geula shel uma zu ba bevas achas. Ella, this is a very, very famous line. You want to sound from. As Zionists say this line. This is a line that Rav Druckman evidently would say very often. This is the line that evidently the Ger Rebbe said when they told him about the UN resolution, November 29, 1947. Kima kima. Kima kima means step by step. Slowly. Everything's going to happen at once. Everything has its right time. Kima kima. Think about it, not just in terms of political issues. Think about it, right? How many of you, since you're all English speakers, right? How many of you know either people in your family or children of other families who made Aliyah and hasn't always worked out for their kids to remain dati? And the kids are wandering a little bit and I understand, I hear a lot of Rabbanim telling people in America you shouldn't make Aliyah. People actually say that. Because in some ways it's easier to raise children in Chutz La'aretz. It's more binary, it's more black and white. Because to be Jewish means to be from, because there's very little way to be Jewish without being from. What does it mean to be Jewish? How am I going to express my Judaism? Here, there's a whole spectrum of Jewish identity. And you could be a secular artist in Tel Aviv, and that's Jewish. And you could be an army officer, and that's a great Jew, and he's a great Jew, and I'm a great Jew. I call it the Shimon Peres syndrome. You remember Shimon Peres? Remember him? He died, you'd think the Vilna Gaon died. As we gave him a spaden. And we gave him a spaden because he contributed to our people and to our nation, etc. So for adults, we're able to put that into perspective. Let's say he contributed, but that's not the pinnacle. The pinnacle would be someone who made those contributions within a religious framework, within a religious umbrella, and that's just one of the values. 15, 16-year-olds don't think complex. 15, 16-year-olds say, oh, that's, I could be Shimon Peres, not Shimon Peres. I could be a secular Israeli and change the country and work for social justice and whatever. So it's a harder mix here for many reasons. And then you throw on top of that the kerosene of being an immigrant. It's called the culture gap. You don't really know the songs. You don't know the language. It's a double whammy. You're walking into a world that's different and new, and you don't even know the ways and the songs and the culture. It's very hard. And I'm not clocking this. I think it's a very, very soulful. I'm already more or less past that stage. I've raised my kids already. My youngest is 17, but I'm a little bit past that stage. So people who are making Aliyah with 10-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds, it is a hard question. But to those who've made Aliyah and are thinking about it, they come and ask me, I said, Kima, it's a long bow, it's a long run. We're bringing ourselves back to this country. There's a lot of things we have to get adjusted to. Your kids are in this country. They're marrying people in this country. They're building Mashiach together. Okay, it may be hard in the immediate sense. I'm not trying to lessen the pain. It's very painful for people. But these are not things that are going to happen overnight. We're not going to solve conversion overnight. We're not going to solve Shemitah overnight. We're not going to solve Haredi secular. There are many, many. It takes a while. It just takes a while to take people from different cultures, different neschos, different backgrounds, and integrate them and build a fabric, build a unifying narrative. Yes?
I don't know if you have an answer or an idea to this, but I guess it's something I think about. Do you have ideas on, it's something that a lot of people think about, but how do you, keep your sense religious when you don't have, as tight communities here and,
Okay, that's a larger question. Really good question. There are too many variables in that. And there's really no one answer. So if we have a conversation, we can have a conversation about that, a whole separate conversation. Because to pinpoint one or two issues would be intellectually dishonest, and you should never be intellectually dishonest or not rigorous, just to say things that are imbalanced, because then you're shading. It's just put things into perspective. What are the four or five issues? What's the more important one? What's the less? It comes off as very disproportionate. And there's a lot of error, not in falsehood, but in disproportion. Most of the errors in life are in disproportion, not falsehood. The glaring falsities in life, we get the glaring. We can see through this. When people take partial truths and expand them to complete truths, and they miss other truths that are, those are normally the biggest errors. So. Especially something as sensitive. People listen to it in recording and feel more. Okay, so maybe remind me some other time during the year we'll talk about that. But
I'm getting a good book about it if you want to read afterwards.
Which book?
It's called Ibrahim Tzin.
Okay, who wrote it?
Something Frank.
Okay, you have to be careful when you read these. You have to be careful. I mean, you want people who are honest and respectful and sympathetic, but if these books are presenting it as if it's the end, you take your choice and you have your choice, and we all know, and it can be very cynical. There was a big uproar in yeshiva. I really wasn't part of that, but one of the days of our Hanukkah seminar, Ruth Calderon, she came to speak, and she was just very, very condescending. Yeah, we all know some people are from us, but not from us. No, this is a yeshiva. Our goal is to be from Hashem. We obviously are not going to discriminate people that aren't from and dehumanize them, but it was just very and I wasn't there, but I remember sitting at the Robin table, she was just very disrespectful to our agenda. Said, yeah, you have ice cream, we have chocolate, we have vanilla, and we all take our pick. And no, we don't see them as two different picks. We see them as one pick and one choice, and everyone makes the right choice. But obviously, if people make the wrong choice, then we're not going to disown them from Jewish identity. Anyway, so getting back to whatever we were talking about before, we forgot what we were talking about. So getting back to that medrash. Kasev echad omer magdil, kasev echad omer kima kima. Ma magdil. So this is the first image that Chazal have. The first image that Chazal have of a slow, gradual redemption is of a building. Now, what makes this image unique? Two things. Number one, who's doing the building? Human beings. Built construction sites. So this implies a human hand, a human partnership, a human share in the process. We're building. And if you go back to that pasuk in Yeshaya, source number 5, the role of human beings in Gula in general, and in the final Gula in particular, is very prominent from the end of the pasuk. Ki lo b'chibazon teitzeu, uvim nusa lo teilechun. So the common denominator of the first part of the pasuk is the speed. It won't be speedy. And to contrast it, it won't be speedy, the Gula is presented as slow. But look how it's presented as slow. Ki holech lifnechem Hashem. Hashem is in the front. Uma'asifchem elokei Yisrael. And he's in the back. So if Hashem's in the front and he's in the back, who's in the middle? We are. What's that an image of? The camp. We're walking and Hashem's in the front and Hashem's in the back. Hashem's leading the charge and Hashem's bringing up the rear. But we're in the middle. And we're setting the pace. The people in the middle set the pace. So that image of Gula as people marching along with Hashem leading and Hashem defending from the rear implies human authorship, human influence, at least regarding the pace. So these two, the Pasuk and Yeshaya, and the Medrash describing David HaMelech, Migdol, building the Geula, building the construction, imply, assume, a human hand. The second part of building, of this metaphor is, as I said before, when you build something, it's completely, completely reasonable, and sometimes even warranted, to pause. There's nothing about the first row of bricks that will be ruined if you let it sit. If anything, sometimes you have to let it sit for the concrete to coagulate, for the bricks to settle in, for the land and the building to take root. So it's totally natural to build, and if you've ever been to a construction site, you'll see that. They'll pour some concrete and they'll wait a day or two for it to dry, for it to take hold, for it to take root. So it's not just the human element which is on display in this metaphor, but it's the need sometimes for a lag. Not just, oh, it's all right, it's lagging, we wish it wouldn't lag, but even if it does lag, still, you know, teach your girls a little Yiddish, they can sound really cool, you want to impress people with Yiddish. You know, you say, afilu hachi, afalpikin in Yiddish, fun des vegan. You want to know Yiddish? Fun des vegan, from that root. Vegan is a root, is a road. For that, I mean, even take the other road. Even if you take the other logic, afilu hachi. So some will say, okay, you know what? It's lagging, but fundesvegen, it's still gula. No, not fundesvegen. Dafka, the fact that there's, specifically, how do you say dafka in Yiddish? Dafka. Dafka, the fact, ever Yiddish is Hebrew words. Dafka, nish fundesvegen. Dafka, because it lags, may make it. And if you read the continuation of that medrash, you'll see this. Now let's read the continuation of the medrash. Source number 6, part 2. Ma'o makdil shi miskadelis volechats lefisha Yisrael. Line number 3. They were 2,000 years in exile. In Tavo Hagiula Bivasachas, if it happens overnight, Einam Yecholim Lisbol Yeshua Gedola. It will be overwhelming. What does it mean to go from Holocaust to Utopia overnight? You have to recover. You have to breathe. You have to rebuild identity. So much of what I want you to pick up from Rav Amital from this class is where are you in history? To know that you're part of a historical process and to have historical awareness and, you know, really shape your life that way exclusively. You want to become whatever you want to become. You want to marry whatever. No, sorry, but Tarek told me I'm going to marry someone, marry history, marry a boy, and raise your family. But just, where are you in history? 100 years from now, your picture is going to be on a wall. What story will that picture tell your grandchildren? They're going to look up at your picture, but you look at your grandparents' picture. What are the words going to be of that story? What will you tell people when you're no longer here, when they gather around Pesach night in 2132, whatever? Oh, my grandmother was the first woman who learned Torah in our family and moved to Israel. Or what story? What story are they going to tell? Right, you're all, like I said, right? So you're about 21, 22. So that means you were born around 201, 202, around then, right? More or less. 2004, so between two. Okay, guys, let's say instead of 2002, let's say you were born in 1922. It's only 80 years apart, not a big span in history. If you were born in 1922, instead of the lives you led, you'd be hiding from Nazis and sewers, watching your parents. So don't spend your life asking why you weren't born in 1922. That's silly. Only Hashem knows. But you can ask yourself that I was born in 2002. Okay, Hashem put me into this context. What does that mean? What are my duties? What are my responsibilities to this world that I'm part of? And that's the first metaphor. Again, Magdil is a process. Migdol is the completion, the tower, the fortress. So Magdil is a process. Migdol is a fortress. Probably the third aspect of gradual redemption that this metaphor conveys, being that we're dealing with a Migdal, not just that it's a human-authored project, and not just that there could be pauses and lags, but that we're building a protection. A Migdal is a fortress to protect people. And we know that part of Geula means leading to a greater protection of Jews and protection of our land. And if you ask me, one of the signs that this is redemptive is that Baruch Hashem, our situation is just becoming more secure, not less secure. When you compare where we were 75 years ago and where we are now, it's incomparable. Basically, we're facing one final threat, and it's Iran, and its proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah. So no one's undermining, belittling that threat, and no one knows how it's going to end. And they told you it's because we're in that fourth room. Doesn't mean that we're immune, God forbid, to suffering. Just have to be very careful. We're invulnerable, we're invincible, we can raid Iran. No, we have to be very cautious. We don't know. Terrible things can happen, Chas v'Shalom. But if you just look at the overall march of the state of Israel, our safety is increasing. Magdil, not Migdal. We're not there yet, but it's increasing. So those are the three elements that this metaphor of gradual geula convey. Human pauses, which is natural. And you need the pause. Not just it's all right to pause. You need the pause. Now, what's the second metaphor of gradual redemption? So the second metaphor of gradual redemption, let me tell you a story. Who has been to Tiberia here? Who likes going to Tiberia? Isn't it nice? Hang out on the beach a little bit. Now, you probably go to Tiberia and you drive up the Kirish Mishparshesh, then you take Shivim, and you go head over. But in the old days, we used to take the Kvish Habika, which is along the Jordan border. There's actually a third way to go there. And that's to go all the way up north till you're parallel to Tiberia. Instead of taking 72, there's this winding road that goes through all these little Yishuvim on the road. It's beautiful. You're driving in the middle of these kibbutzim. And the Americans from New York, it's like driving through the Catskill Mountains. You're driving through woods, and you're driving through water, and you're driving through little shanty towns. And if you look at it on Google Maps, the road looks like a snake. It's up and down and up and down and up. If you get car sick, not a good trip to take, but very scenic road getting to Tiberia. If you take that road, I don't know what it's called. It's probably four numbers because it's a small road. If you take that road, the last kibbutz you pass before you hit Tiberia is a kibbutz called Arabel. Who lived in Arabel? Nita Arabeli. Now in Arabel, it's right overlooking the Kinneret. And in Arabel, there's a lot of big boulders and cliffs. And if you stand in Arabel at the right time of the morning, you can see the sunrise coming through the cliff, coming through these big boulders, these big mountains. And this is a story about two Tanaim who were walking in Arabel and saw the sunrise. I don't know if they saw it through the rocks, but they saw the sunrise. No better scene than watching the sunrise on Arabel over the Kinneret through the cliffs in the mountain. So maybe Ben Azman, if you can go there. Sleep there one night in the kibbutz. Part of the nice part is you just sleep on the grass somewhere. What? Oh, yeah? Okay. Did you see the sunrise?
No.
Go back. Ben Azman. Okay, so let's see what happened. Source number 9. Rav Chiya Ruba, Rav Shimon ben Chalafta, Hayim Halchim Bahada, Bikat Arabel Bekritzta. They were walking through the valley of Arabel in the morning. Ro ayelas hashachar. They see the sunrise. Amar Rav Chiya Ruba Rav Shimon ben Chalafta. He says to him immediately, Kachi gulasan shel Yisrael. And what phrase does he use? Kima kima. Same phrase. This is our phrase. Kima kima. And that's sunrise. You're waiting for the sun. You're looking out, I guess. That would be what? North? What's that north there? That would be north, south, east. You're looking that way. Looking for the sun. You see it a little. You're on the porch of Migdalos, trying to see the sunrise. You see the first flash across the horizon. It's very, very slow. And then you turn to your friends. Let's get some coffee. We'll come back. We look at your phone a little bit. They turn back and look, the whole eastern horizon is ablaze with. It starts off slow. What image of gradual is conveyed by this? What's the difference between a sunrise and between building a fortress? So first of all, it's the opposite. There's no human element here. Human beings can't control the sunrise. There's a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and even Hashem sometimes provides it in stages. That returns to what I said before. Even though if you were to measure sunrise scientifically, there's no difference between the first 2 minutes and the last 2 minutes in its effect, but experientially you feel as if it accelerates. The beginning it's slow and it gets faster. It doesn't really get faster. But experientially, because you're seeing more light, because there's more sun rays that are hitting you, you just feel like it's happening faster. The sun's rising faster. The sun moves at the same pace. Actually, the sun doesn't move. We move. We move at the same pace. The sun appears to move also at the same pace, but it feels as if it's gaining steam. It feels as if it's moving a lot faster as it continues, as it unfolds. The third issue is, this is a biggie, that Gula is bringing light, not just building a building. And we believe that Gula brings light, not just to ourselves, but as the sun does to the entire world. There's a universalism to the sun. You don't have when the tower that we're building, presumably to protect ourselves, or in Yerushalayim, Migdal David, or Migdal Yerushalayim. I remember I once got on a plane. I'm going to start traveling again. So it was after a long, long day in Chicago. Anyone know Chicago people here? Chicago. So really long day. I got up 4 in the morning in New York. Went to Chicago, gave shiurim, bar mitzvah, wedding, the whole nine yards. Come to the airport at 9 o'clock, exhausted. And I see on the board, the flight is delayed. It's a big airport, and flights get delayed there a lot. It's called O'Hare Airport. So I've been there a lot, a lot of delays there. So I find a little corner, have my sandwich, start learning. And finally, fortunately enough, at like 1:30 in the morning, they finally released the plane to fly to New York, the only plane they released. I schlep onto the plane, my bag, back of the plane, sit down, exhausted. I've basically been up 24 hours. I turn to the guy next to me, just to be courteous, and I say, have a pleasant flight. He says, okay, you have a pleasant flight also? I say, yes, finally. I have a 2-hour flight from New York, Chicago to New York. No one knows who I am. I don't have to talk to anyone. No one knows my name. I could just learn. Take out my Gemara, I start learning. Happiest person in the world. All of a sudden, the guy next to me is a bit of a nudnik. He starts talking to me. He says, what are you doing? I said, I'm reading. I think I was reading. So, what are you reading? I said, well, it's ancient Jewish law. He said, well, what part of ancient Jewish law are you reading? I was learning Maseches Nida. So, I told him, ancient Jewish hygiene. He said, what's the name of the book? And I said, well, it's something called Talmud. When I said the word Talmud, he stopped me in my tracks and he said the 5 words I least wanted him to say. He says to me, don't worry, I'm Jewish. I know what Talmud is. I look up to Hashem and I say, Hashem, I've been working for you for 18 hours. 18 hours. All I want is 2 hours to myself. You couldn't send me next to a stewardess, next to a Buddhist priest or an Irish monk or some atheist or something. I sit next to the only Jew on. You know, Hashem calls, you got to say yes. I stopped making small talk with this guy. What does he do? I think his name was Morris. What does he do? He's a pretty young guy, professor in MIT. I'm a Rebbe in Gush. Right off the bat, we have a lot in common. I gave him some tips about how to be a better teacher. We're trying to help him out a little bit. Then he tells me, he says, Rabbi, I don't understand. So, I'm married. Yeah, I'm married. How many kids? Whatever, a bunch of kids. He says, I just don't get this thing called marriage. He says, I can understand where at a certain point in time your arc and a woman's arc overlap and are symmetrical and convergent, but you'll keep growing and she'll keep growing and your arcs will diverge. I'm trying to explain to this MIT professor, love and marriage isn't physics. It's not physics, not trajectory. I should have told him it's chemistry, right? It's not physics. It's not trajectory. Okay, so I took his number, so I'll try to get you a shidduch, and I never really called him back. And then at some point, I was just trying to like get this nudnik off my back already. He says, Rabbi, I always wanted to know. I said, oh God, that's a shocker. I always wanted to know what makes Judaism different from all other religions. Oh gosh, okay. Close the Gemara Nida, put it aside. I got to convert this guy. So one of the things I told him, only one, I got the whole thing. I said, let me tell you something. I said, you know that every Christian has a bullseye on your back. Because every Christian has you as a target. And in their end game, everyone becomes a Christian or is killed as the infidel. There's only one way. And every Muslim has placed a bullseye on your back. Because in Islamic messianic narrative, every single person becomes a Muslim or is eliminated as the infidel, and fundamentalist Islam is already acting upon that agenda. Judaism has absolutely zero missionary agenda. We have absolutely no interest in missionarizing and converting any single person to be a Jew. And at the end of the day, you know what happens? We remain Jewish. And the world sees Hashem through us in a way they can't yet see him. And they live a life, a non-Jewish life, of morality and monotheism and kindness and civility, which, by the way, they're pretty close to. The only difference is all the hatred and anti-Semitism. And once they see Hashem, their lives, quite frankly, are improved. So we are the most universal religion, like it blew his head off. Because people always think about Judaism as bigoted and chosen people and racist. No, we're the most universal. We're the only religion who doesn't say we're the only religion. We're the only religion who says our goal is not to turn you Jewish. Our goal is to inspire you to 7 by a life of 613. We live 613 and you're inspired to 7. So when I'm addressing Mashiach, when I'm advancing Mashiach, I'm not just doing it for the Jewish people. I'm doing it for the whole world. I told you my mental experiment a few weeks ago. You have 24 hours. You can either solve cancer or settle the hilltop in the West Bank. The obvious answer is settle the hilltop in the West Bank because you'll bring now. The reason you won't do that is because you just don't know and it's not rational. But if you knew that A led to B, because you would solve every single illness, every single affliction of humanity. Because our messianic process is not insular. It's not national. It's global. It's the rising of the sun. That's what this metaphor suggests. The sun rises for everyone. That is if the Jews receive the rays of the sun and no one else. And that's what this metaphor, you have to read these midrashim carefully. Learn to read things carefully and striate them. This is really fascinating because I told you before, the Jewish people didn't listen to Moshe because they were too pressured. And when you're pressured, you can't think about long term. And you just try the following experiment. I'll experiment and I'll tell you a cute story. Okay? Experiment. Tonight, Google, go to YouTube, and look at the top music video from 1983. Just pick it from 30 years ago. And just watch it. I don't care what it is. And try to see if you can detect the difference between that video and the top music video of 2023. Now, the real difference you'll notice is it's called FPSs, frames per second. How much information is your head processing per second? And you'll see it's a much slower video from 1983. And your mind has to process less visuals, less information. And when your mind isn't occupied processing more info, more intake, you have more depth, more time, more internalization. It's hard for me to describe it, but our world was a much quieter world. Our world was a much slower world. We didn't have phones. It was one phone. I remember, so my daughter's getting married. I was just nostalgic. When I wanted to speak to my wife, I had to call her home and speak to her parents like I speak to a Tara can I speak to. Which means you didn't speak as often. You didn't feel the need to respond. Sometimes when I sit with people and I hear their WhatsApps buzzing every 10, 15 seconds, I cry for them. I know the pressure sometimes I feel when I know that I'm not responding. Should I respond right away? Do I have to respond? I'd rather learn. Just people are always under pressure. I think a lot about that pasuk in Vayera. What you lose is you lose long-term vision because you're just so anchored in the immediate sense of the moment of what I have to do right now and today. And I remember speaking to a Holocaust survivor. I asked him, what were you thinking during the Holocaust? And he told me something very interesting. And I wonder, certain people were able to process long-term issues during the Holocaust. I've read Viktor Frankl, a very famous psychologist. But he told me that he and his friends, thinking about processing, we were completely in survival mode. It was just one foot ahead of the other foot trying to make it through the day. No one was thinking, no one was considering, no one was pondering life, no one was pondering the meaning of evil. We just wanted to survive. How can I make it through the day? And you know that, right? You know there's certain days in your life where you're just under so much pressure. I know myself, for example. I'm on the road. I've had a terrible, terrible road trip and I haven't slept in 3 nights. I'm just saying, okay, right now, my goal for the day is just to make it through the day. Get my 10 tests and just, not do it. I just don't have my wits about me, my strength, my head, my sanity, my health. I just feel like, okay, I just break it down to the bare minimum. Just survive the day and live to see another, live to fight another battle. So what's the story I wanted to tell you? Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, really, really, really fascinating personality of the 20th century. He was everywhere. He was in the yeshiva of Slobodka. He had contact with Rav Kook. And then he formed the yeshiva, yeshiva. Notice I didn't use the word Haredi in Yorko Chaim Berlin. It's just fascinating. It's one of Rav Lichtenstein's Rebbeim. Look up a wiki. He wrote a sefer which is probably the closest sefer to Rav Kook in terms of its mysticism called Pachad Yitzchak. A sefer people like to use. Really fascinating. Real thinker. So he once saw some boys going on a bus. And in those days, the minhag when you were on the bus was to learn a sefer. And he blew up at that, was furious. He says, you have a bus ride and you have all that time to think and you're going to waste it by reading. What would Rav Kuttner say today? He said, please read a book. Please read a book. Just take a book on the bus. Put your phone down. Yeah, like when these people tell me, Rabbi, I want to go see a movie. Why? Because I think movies are going to change my life. I said, please. Don't tell me these movies are going to change your life. They're not deep. They're not made for thinkers. If they're made for thinkers, they won't make any money. They're made for lowest common denominators, good guys, bad guys, gratuitous sex, violence and shooting, to make a lot of money, put your little body in the seat, buy some popcorn and chocolate, give them a lot of money, buy some action figures. They're not deep. Rabbi Inception. No, trust me, they're not deep. Here's my check. Here we go. Go to a library. Just pick any random book off of the library. Open to any random page. Read any random page of any random book. You'll have 10 times the meaning of all the movies you just mentioned. Because there's subtlety and there's sophistication that words and ideas convey that visuals cannot. It's built in. So I know there are some movies that are superior to shoot 'em ups or to romantic comedies. Trust me, I know that. But the level of depth you get is nowhere near reading something well written. I promise you, any article that I've read will give you much more meaning than any movie you'll ever see in your entire life. And I'm not hooting, I'm not hawking my own articles. I'm describing the degraded intellectualism of these movies. It's impossible, even if Shakespeare made a movie, it's impossible to create subtlety and sophistication at that level. You can, good actors convey it. I'm a fan of good actors. I'm not against movies. I'm against people deluding themselves. If you want to see a movie because you want to have a good time, go. If you want to have a date, go. But don't justify it that you're looking for meaning. Enjoy. You want to relax? You want to sleep? I love going to movies with my kids. I get 2 hours of sleep. I pay three times the ticket. You want to? I remember once I was telling the boys yesterday. I remember once walking home from a lunch from the yeshiva with a boy about 20 years ago who was addicted to Game Boy. Remember Game Boys? Anyone ever have a Game Boy? This little thing with you. I was trying to plead with him, please put it down, stop. It's not adding anything to your life, it's just a distraction. And he was piously trying to defend. He says, Rabbi, you know it adds so much to my life. I'm saying, well, tell me, what does it add to your life? And he says, Rabbi, it improves my hand-eye coordination. I said, what, you won't be a sniper? What do you hand-eye coordination? What do you do? I don't like when people tell themselves tales. You have to be honest with yourself so you can grow. Remember, the two ingredients for that cake we call change, listen carefully, stop talking, this is important. The two ingredients for that cake we call change are honesty and courage. First step is honesty, first ingredient, second ingredient is courage. If you're not honest, you can't identify. If you're not courage, you can't. I know a lot of boys and girls, but I know boys better, that get stuck in between. They're honest enough to know how they have to change, they don't have the courage to make the change. Some people are just not honest enough, and lack of honesty is many, many different levels. I mean, it's completely out of touch with reality, delusional thing. I mean, every of those people are out of touch. Okay, so that's the second image. The second image of a gradual redemption. The first one is the building. The second one is the sunrise. What's the third one? So the third one actually quotes our story. So let's see. Turn the page. Is it here? I hope it's here. Yeah, Medrash Rabbah, source number 7, Bamidbar Rabbah. So what's the image? Okay. Shir HaShirim, as you know, is the great, great book of Jewish history. And it's about a love between Hashem and Am Yisrael, and the love that's a product of a partnership in history, that we're trying to change history. It's the book to read if you want to understand Jewish history and Zionism and historical role. But you really need to have people teach it to you. It's not easy. That, Eov and Koheles, are the three svarim that you cannot tackle without guidance. You'll just get totally, totally lost. Yevon Gralish is because it's too complicated. Like, there's too much. And Shir HaShirim because it's too poetic. You just know what he's talking about. It's just too metaphoric, right? Metaphors are intentionally about multiple meanings, right? David HaMelech is a terrible poem. He's a terrible poet. He wasn't writing poetry. He was writing hymns. Hymns are powerful, raw, religious, outpouring, straight, forward. Shlomo HaMelech is writing poetry. Poetry is vague, ambiguous, invites multiple meaning. What's the difference between a hymn and a poem? Do you finish your metaphor? David HaMelech is always ruining the metaphor. He's not writing a metaphor, he's writing what he feels. When you say what you feel, you want to be exact. Kiayal tarog alafike moyim. What a beautiful metaphor. How many different meanings could I think about a ram leaping on the banks of the river if I'm a poet? Kain tarog alafshiela. Don't finish it! Don't say kain tarog alafshiela. Don't finish it, David HaMelech. Just let me think. That's the difference. David HaMelech wrote hymns, psalms. You say, I love you, Hashem. I need you. This is my need. This is my semelach hanafshi lekim lekel chai. I call out to you. It's like a flowing river in which the trees provide. Eitz l'tshuva. Shlomo HaMelech is talking theory. People are talking to each other in metaphors. Like, what does this mean? What is she referring to? What is he referring to? And be very, very careful. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Don't ever turn Shir HaShirim into a love song. That is the worst disgraceful thing you can do. Chazal were irate about that. This is Rabbi HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Am Yisrael. How dare you reroute that into not silly, love isn't silly, but relative, silly little love songs between man and woman. It's just, don't let it happen. Run as far as you can. This is Kodesh Kadoshim. This is about ourselves and the Bona Shalom. And because the love between man and woman is so powerful, it's used as a metaphor to capture it. But it has to be a metaphor to capture something deeper, not the end point. I remember once I was in a hotel for Pesach, and they were reading Shir HaShirim, and just, it bothers me sometimes, because I always hear when people read Tehillim, because Tehillim, in Hebrew, Israeli ceremonies, is read like a poem. It just, it grates at me. It's pious. We have a way, Lam Natseach Mismar L'David Yanecha Hashem B'yam Tzarah, you're crying, and Lam Natseach Mismar L'David Yanecha Hashem B'yam Tzarah. You've heard it, right? You've heard the Tehillim. Just like there's so much piety. So many people have said these Tehillims, crying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. I'm going to take it. Well, this guy got up in this Pesach. One Pesach, our Chag of Cheros, Shir HaShirim, Mashir HaShirim. The kiva is rolling in his grave. The grave is rolling in the grave.
I thought it was like woman's on the man. My father went. Yeah,
it's just, Lee, it's just people just don't get it. You know what it is? It's the tragedy of a life without transcendence. Listen to that phrase. We're becoming a religion untranscendicized, which is all about trying to justify religion in our own terms. Social justice, what makes sense to us, and love. And the power of Judaism, it doesn't run away from this world, but there's also some other world. And it's the world of Hashem and his logic and a higher place and a higher being. And we're losing that flight. As I hear about him speak, and it's just there's no flight to them. There's no altitude. Religion is just our world and our thoughts and our people and our... What about Kodesh Baruch Hu? What about something higher? What about some other world? What about, and this is a perfect example, to take the Sefer, which is historical, talks about Jews martyring themselves throughout history and the love that Hashem gives to people and to turn it into Romeo and Juliet. I'm a very tolerant person. It's more intellectually humiliating than it is morally repugnant. Like, just don't you get it? Don't you get it? Like, which hole has your head been in all these years? Anyway, so what are we talking about? We're talking about... yeah, right. So in Shir HaShirim, because of such a love description between Hashem and his people, they're actually animals. One animal that captures Hashem. We're described as doves. Yonasi b'chag v'asela b'seisra madriga. Yonasi tamasi hashminis kolech. And Hashem is compared to a deer. Dome dodi l'tzvi. O l'ofer hayalim ha'ivater. Okay, why is Hashem compared Hashem is like a deer. Why is Hashem compared to a deer? Remember, this is the only time in Tanakh that there's an image applied to Hashem. Not exactly true, but close enough. Because we don't apply images. Would you say Hashem finishes and Hashem is like? No, you wouldn't. Because anything we conjure is completely incompatible with Hashem by definition. That sense has to end with nothing. Hashem is like nothing. That's why in Tanakh, the only image that we apply to Hashem is a cloud, a nun. Because a cloud is distortion of vision. The only way we can describe Hashem is by describing something you can't see, not something you can't see. Did I ever tell you my rainbow shot? Did I ever tell you my rainbow shot? Okay. That's just to show you have to know physics to understand imagery. Okay? So, look at the air around you. How many colors do you see? Physics?
All but one.
All the colors. Yeah. All the colors of the spectrum, all but one. So when you're seeing a particular color, so all the rays are being repelled, and the blue is being absorbed. So you see this is blue. Okay? When you see all the colors together, you see nothing. So light is a metaphor for something which is invisible, not because it doesn't exist, but it's invisible because it's everything. Who is invisible because he's everything? Hashem. When do we realize that secret of invisibility because he's everything? When we see a rainbow. The rainbow reminds us that we're really seeing nothing as we're seeing everything. So the rainbow is a one-off reminder that sometimes invisibility is not lack of existence, but complete and total comprehensiveness. So Hashem says, I'm like a rainbow. I'm coming to you in a rainbow. Now you're seeing me. You're not going to always see me for the rest of history, but just know you're not seeing me not because I don't exist. You're not seeing me because I'm everything. And sometimes your mind can't see everything. You just need our physics to understand some of these metaphors. Did I tell you last week about the burning bush? No? A little bit? No? Okay, what's fire? Combustion. What are the three elements necessary for combustion? Havara?
Oxygen, source.
Okay, fuel, energy, and oxygen. Fuel is wood, coal, oil, whatever. Energy is heat, light, whatever. Without oxygen, there won't be oxidation. So there'll be energy, but it won't consume. It oxidizes, it breaks it down. So Torah is compared to fire. So just like in combustion for fire, Torah has three elements to it. So what is being consumed? The fuel, Torah. What is the energy? The effort you put forth to study Torah. What's that third oxygen-like invisible element without which Torah can't be studied? Hashem. Without Hashem helping you study Torah, you won't study Torah. So the fuel, in order to be consumed by the energy, needs Hashem. At this point, Hashem hadn't yet descended into history. So there was no combustion because there was no oxygen. There was fire, but no combustion because Hashem was not yet in history. He said, don't worry, I will come into history and there will be combustion when the Sinai turns into Har Sinai and then the mountain will start burning. Hashem is teaching us that he's like oxygen. He's that invisible element without which this process can't take place. So the Sinai turns into Har Sinai. In the beginning, there's no combustion, there's just a fire. Ultimately, at Har Sinai, there's a lot of combustion. Har Bar Ha'esh, Adlev HaShemayim. Not Labas Eish, but Adlev HaShemayim, burned until heavens itself. So Chazal didn't know all the physics, so there are other pshats they gave, but if you get down to the physics, we believe this is all truth. So the physics has to match the pshat. So you have to understand the physics to understand the concepts. Okay, so Hashem's compared to a deer. Why is Hashem compared to a deer in Shir HaShir? Okay, so let's see the Medrash. Source number 7. Dome dodi litzvi. Ma hatzvi hazeh. Nigla v'chazer v'nichse. Guys, come, we're on vacation. We're in the bungalow. We're up north. We're in the tzimmer. There are deers outside. It's the morning. Quickly, come look. There's some deers outside on our patio in our merpeset. Everyone gets out of bed and runs out there. And deer's gone. But it's not really gone. It's just hiding behind the bush. And if you wait long enough, deer comes out and you get to see it again. Deers don't disappear. They just conceal and then emerge. Conceal and emerge. Nigla, v'chozer v'nichsa, closed and revealed, available and visible. Kach goel harishon, the first geula, Moshe Rabbeinu. Hashem, during the days of Moshe. Nigla v'nichsa, skipping a line, Zem Moshe, nigla lehem, The Chazar v'nechsamehem. Our parsha, Shmos in Vayirah, line number 3, source 7. Kama nechsamehem. Rabbi Tanchuma Omer Shlosh Chadashim. 3 months. Our 3 months, right here. In those 3 months, the deer had disappeared, but the deer wasn't disappeared. The deer was just hanging behind the bush we call Mizra. And Chazal say, now look back at line number 2, Reb Levi, Recha B'Shem Reb Levi, Amar, Ki Goel HaRishon, Kach Goel HaAchron. Just like it happened in the days of Moshe, it will happen in our days. You may not always see Goel. Maybe points of frustration. But it's there, even though you can't see it. And that's what the third metaphor conveys, that the other two didn't. Not just gradual, not just, but sometimes you don't always see it. But it's still there. Now, Rav Amital didn't quote all these midrashim to us at this depth. He just quoted them as, I've thought about them, obviously, since he quoted them. This whole orientation. And it's not going to be immediate, and don't expect it, and don't lose hope, and don't... Remember I said grounding? Grounding messiness. I'm proud to be a messianist. I'm also proud to be a grounded messianist. I hate labels. I'm not going to start a movement called Grounded Messianist. If I would, I'd call it that. Okay, about 15 years ago, a woman from the New York Times interviewed me. What do you think about those settlers in Hebron? I said, I'm a settler. She said, no, those settlers in Hebron that carry guns. I showed her my Uzi, I used to carry an Uzi. No, those settlers in Hebron who carry guns, who believe that every centimeter of this land is theirs. She's trying to bait me into disparaging. I wouldn't be baited. She says, but you don't look like them. You don't sound like them. You don't talk like them. Don't be baited in life, okay? Be strong enough not to be baited. If someone's trying to bait you into saying what you don't want to say, be strong enough, okay? I'll say what I want to say, and what I want to say, you're not put words in my mouth. So she asked me, okay, what's the difference? The difference I said is, I'm a messiness. I believe in all those things. But just because I'm a messiness doesn't mean that I don't want to follow, respect the legal rights of other people, that I feel that we should act impractically, that I think, I was just basically saying what I just told you. She said, well, what should I call you? Like, how should I give the byline? I said, messianism flavored with pragmatism. Messianism flavored, assaulted, forget what I said. I'm a messianist, but we flavor it with pragmatism. Pragmatism, morality, halacha. But don't give up your messianism. Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein, each in their own way, create his groundedness. And I don't know all the homes you're from, but certainly the Israelis, probably, if you're here, it's probably, and you're not, let's say, in other Dati Lumi places, which we feel very aligned with. Don't create divisions. But I think these are some of the nuances. Runaway messianism. And runaway messianism, and therefore the rights of the others are less, are not important at all, or moral considerations can be dwarfed by larger messianic. And that whole Pandora's box, which messianism invites of issues, you know, Aaron and Amital were very steady, very cautious, halacha first, morality first, respecting other people first. Doesn't mean that you're not involved in the redemptive process. And that's part of what Rav Amital gave. Okay? Good stories. Good Torah. Good Midrashim. Hand-eye coordination. Order. Go to Amazon tonight and order your book of Rav Amital, and maybe they'll throw in a Game Boy. Game Boy. Yes. What's your name? Liana what? Grossman. Where are you from?